Welcome back to this weekly meeting of the Health and Safety Committee with Denver City Council. Coverage of the Health and Safety Committee starts now.
Good morning. This is Wednesday, August 6th, the Health and Safety Committee. My name is Daryl Watson. I'm honored to be the chair of this committee, and I'm honored to serve all residents of the fine District 9. We have one action item and four consent items, but before we begin our presentations, we'll do brief introductions of council members. Why don't we start from our right with Council President Pro Tem.
Good morning. Diana Romero Campbell, Southeast Denver, District 4.
Morning. I'll leave off the good. Kevin Flynn, Southwest Denver, District 2.
Hi, everyone. Serena Gonzalez Gutierrez, one of your council members at large.
Hi, Amanda Sawyer, District 5. Jamie Torres, West Denver, District 3.
Good morning. Stacey Gilmore, District 11.
Good morning. Amanda Sandoval, Northwest Denver, District 1.
Sarah Cody, your other council member at large.
Buenos dias. Flora Libres from Lucky, District 7.
Welcome, everyone, to our safety meeting. We have one action item, and it's a presentation action. Action item 251117, an ordinance concerning the disclosure of non-monetary settlements. And I turn it over to Councilmember Torres and Councilmember Gilmore.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much, council members. It's Councilmember Gilmore and I are really glad to get this over the line. It's a small but really important modification to the municipal code. And so what it ultimately does is ensure transparency in all of our public safety settlement agreements. This is kind of what we're going to go over today, and want to start off with some ground setting, I think, from Julia Richmond, who chairs the Citizen Oversight Board. To ensure lasting transparency and community trust, the Citizen Oversight Board recommends the disclosure of non-monetary settlement obligations be established in a formal policy and potentially in an ordinance. So this was part of a letter that we received in 2024. It was the second letter from the Citizen Oversight Board to leadership at the time, which I was president at the time of the first letter. Now President Sandoval was president at the time of the second letter, and we definitely needed to figure out what is the problem and how do we try to resolve it. And so Councilmember Gilmore and I were asked to dig in and try to figure out what needed to be done on this. A little bit of the background from the letters. The COB reviewed nearly over 150 settlement agreements because they were not sure that they were seeing all of the agreement indicators or settlements that were not kind of the monetary disclosure. So those could be training, those could be something additional. I've been a part of some settlement agreements that required a community meeting be arranged for community partners. Some of those were not always shared with the monitor or the Citizen Oversight Board. In fact, in four major cases, those non-monetary settlements were not disclosed so that the Citizen Oversight Board and the Office of the Independent Monitor could make sure that they were tracking everything that the city agreed to do and, in fact, were able to carry out in doing. And they found that there was no requirement for the public disclosure of those items, and so that was what prompted them to email Denver City Council. So the recommendation from the COB was that we need to establish a formal policy. We need to make sure that a key partner, whether it was the city attorney or the clerk and recorder, trigger some way to communicate those non-monetary settlements to COB and the OIM. In the future, codify that so they can ensure the oversight and accountability through their independent review. So we made a couple small changes to the section that speaks to records, access to records by the Office of the Independent Monitor. So this is the new section 2-390. It requires full cooperation from our safety departments, Department of Safety, Police, Sheriff, and Fire. Mandates written explanations for delays or denials. It allows the monitor's office to participate in policy development and requires proactive notification of policy and practice changes. So the new disclosure requirements ask for within 30 days of that final settlement or 30 days of council approval, the city attorney would forward the full agreement to the monitor's office and the Citizen Oversight Board. And it applies to two key areas: allegations of improper conduct by public safety and agreements that require some kind of departmental action. What this does not apply to are settlements of discipline or disqualification appeals initiated by uniform personnel. That has a separate process. So three of the four cases that the Citizen Oversight Board looked at and found that they did not know that there were non-monetary settlement agreements were these three cases: 2018 Michael Marshall, 2014 Jamal Hunter, and 2008 Emily Rice. I think overall what this means for the city of Denver is that we are not the only ones who are knowledgeable council members, that is, of settlement agreements. We get briefings of those, we approve those, but that somebody out there, especially our Citizen Oversight Board and Independent Monitor, are notified as well and are able to track the progress, because we are also not the body to do that. And we wanna make sure that there is somebody out there that is. Obviously, it doesn't occur in every case. It doesn't occur in most cases, but when it does mean something. Either a training needed to be modified or given, that records needed to be kind of monitored, and somebody needed to do that. So hope that this becomes something that improves our public trust, the transparency that we've given over to the Independent Monitor and the COB and their independent authority. So today we're here at Health Safety Committee. These are the next dates that we anticipate this, pending your approval, would come through City Council with a second and final reading on August 25th. And we're open for questions.
Thank you so much, Councilmember Torres. I wanted to ask Councilmember Gilmore, was there any additional information you wanted to share? We do have public comment, and so we'll go to public comment first before we go to the queue of council members.
Well, thank you, Committee Chair. I appreciate the partnership with Councilwoman Torres and the trust by Council President Sandoval in assigning this to both of us to work on this. I think it's really important to also thank the Citizen Oversight Board and Julia Richmond. She has been an unwavering community voice and partner in this very real work that affects our communities, and most times those in our communities who look like many of us around this table, but are also struggling in some way enough that they're gonna dial 911 and expect somebody to show up to help them or be out in public and expect that they're going to be engaged with in a humanitarian manner, or if they are, our responsibility within our jails, within the process, we need to make sure that we're training people appropriately so that how they engage becomes muscle memory. Yeah. And I think that is so important, because we all know the stress that we're under on a day-to-day basis, and we don't carry a gun, and we are not faced with scenes and scenarios that forever change people. And if we don't raise that up as a priority in our city, there is no way that we can police ourselves into public safety. That is impossible. We're going to celebrate our 250th commemoration of these United States, and we still don't have some of these parts of our government and policy right and just for people. And so when I think of someone in our jail and have watched those videos, because you have to see it sometimes to think about, if I was that person in a uniform, how would I react in those situations? And we will never ever know, but I want the people that are in those positions to have the support to behave correctly in those situations. And we can only do that by peer pressure, but that doesn't work. It's gotta be law, it's gotta be policy. And so thanking Julia for her work and her voice and you know, the Office of the Independent Monitor. I helped hire Liz Castle. I was given the great honor and responsibility by then Council President Torres to lead that process and be part of that process. And I got to talk to the other candidates for this independent monitor position that applied across the country. And when you talk about this, you need somebody who is going to be able to rise to the moment and ask the questions that at the end of the day, as elected officials, we have the fiscal responsibility and the budget oversight of the city. And we need to make sure that we're not putting the taxpayers' dollars at financial risk by not training people appropriately or by not separating employment, quite frankly, with people that they're just not the right fit, and offering the therapy hours that they need. Those are important steps, and it's not going to happen unless we enact it into policy, because if it was going to happen, it would have happened already. And we see what is happening across our nation, and we need to make sure that the people who are representing Denver are trained the best, and that there is accountability within the ranks, and that if not, that's why we have the Citizen Oversight Board, the Office of the Independent Monitor, and then to do this work, because the Denver Police Department wants to get this right too. The leadership is there. Chief Thomas was our commander in District 5. When I started out on council, Chief Thomas was our commander. So I have worked with Chief Thomas as a district council person, as a resident of Montbello. And I have to say that I think he wants to do what's right, but we as council need to also be asking the questions and around the education-based discipline. I want to ask you all, if you would feel comfortable with that being the policy of your physician, if that would be the policy for your lawyer, if that would be the policy for someone who works in a daycare or in a school with your child, would you think that an education-based disciplinary mechanism was going to protect them? And that's the question. And so the reason I'm bringing that to this body is because I know the power and the hearts of this body, and we need to have that accountability, that sometimes you have to sit in a room with a therapist, and it might be more than 12 hours of the allotted time now that we're giving Department of Safety personnel, because we're going to get this wrong, because they're under grave stress, and we want to support them. And so by doing this, I really want to thank Emily Lauk with the Department of Safety, because Emily has been in every meeting when we were, you know, I was kicking around these ideas, what can we do better, what can we do different, and that this will be a policy that makes a difference so that we're recording, we know what the monetary amounts are, and we know that we pay out hundreds of millions of taxpayer dollars towards that. We need to record the non-monetary ones because they are just as important and they're the law, and we should be responsible to the families and the taxpayers to do that right. And so, you know, we have a policy list of ideas that way back when I talked to Nick Mitchell, who was the original, the OG independent monitor, because there's not that many of them across the nation. Denver is unique in that fact. And Nick Mitchell, we talked for about 45 ideas, and he just threw out policy ideas from the federal, the state, the local. And so I was just visiting with Councilwoman Torres before, and we'll unearth that and share that with the body, because that's the work that you all will continue on after I am no longer in this role. So thank you so much for the partnership and the little bit of privilege to give you a little bit of history and kind of the why behind it. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much, Councilmember Gilmore, and really your service on this committee and the work that's being done here. And Councilmember Torres, we do have a public comment that is scheduled, and then we're gonna roll to opening the queue for Councilmember comments. We have six members of council already in the queue. But for our comment section for the public, we have Lizbeth Perez Castle, who's the current independent monitor, and Julie Richmond. And so the ask would be if, Lizbeth, if you don't wanna start us off, if you don't mind coming up, introducing yourself. There's about 2 minutes provided. There should be a notification on the screen. If there isn't, I'll wave my hand wildly as they come to 30 seconds to let you know that your time is running out. But Lizbeth, I'll turn the floor over to you.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. Good morning, Council. And thank you for giving me the opportunity to just make a brief statement to you all today. The OIM supports the addition to the ordinance, as it will increase transparency and provide accountability for harm done by law enforcement. This amendment will allow the OIM the opportunity to review not just instances of individual harm, but consider whether there's a systemic harm that needs to be addressed. The OIM as an oversight agency is in the best position to review these settlements, oversee their implementation, and report back to the community and to council. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And then Julia Richmond.
Thank you for having us today. Dear members of the Denver City Council, the Denver Citizen Oversight Board fully supports the changes to the...
Introducing yourself.
Oh, sure.
I did already, but yes. Just for the record.
I'm Julia Richmond. I'm the chair of the Citizen Oversight Board. The board fully supports the changes to the Denver Revised Municipal Code that the council members have introduced. The proposed changes would require the city attorney's office to provide us with copies of any final settlement agreements related to the Department of Safety that include non-monetary terms or commitments. These non-monetary provisions are often critical to making structural changes that can prevent future harm, and proposed ordinance changes will allow us to monitor the extent to which these important commitments are complied with. Over the years, there have been several examples of non-monetary settlement terms that have driven large and lasting improvements. Unfortunately, as we described in our November 2023 letter, there have also been examples of terms that the city has either not fully complied with or has done the bare minimum to comply with, denying the potential benefits to our community and increasing the chances of another tragedy. We are grateful that the DOS has voluntarily taken the significant step of beginning to proactively disclose any settlements containing these terms. Even so, we believe that giving us the ability to independently verify those disclosures will demonstrate the city's commitment to accountability and strengthen the foundation upon which community trust is built. Thank you for taking our concerns about this issue seriously and investing the time and energy to draft this language and consider this bill.
Thank you, Julia. And we know that our process for signing up, especially for committee discussions, for public comment, sometimes is a little antiquated. And so I wanted to provide an opportunity if there's anyone in the audience that also wanted to speak or share any thoughts. I'll provide 2 minutes. Please introduce yourself or organization that you represent. And so we have opportunity because Julia and Elizabeth were so brief in their comments, we have additional time. And I'll do a quick pause to see if there's anyone else. Seeing no one else, that is excellent. We have 5 city council members signed up for comment. And after that, this is an action item. We'll ask for a motion and a second and a vote on committee. First, we have Councilmember Sawyer and then Council President Sandoval.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Thank you guys so much for doing this. It has, for those of us who were here during the race and social justice demonstrations in 2020, this is one of those things that we all struggled really, really hard with. And I don't remember much about 2020 because it was crazy and we were all working like 80-hour weeks. But I can clearly remember having a conversation with Nick Mitchell where I said to him, I don't understand. What do you mean you don't get this information as the independent monitor? Like, I can tell you where I was standing in my office while I was on the phone with him having this conversation. That's how clearly I remember having it. So I'm so grateful to you that you have brought forward this change to the DRMC. I do think that it is important, and I do think that it is needed, and I do 100% believe that our police leadership and sheriff leadership also think that this is important and needed. So I think we're all on the same page here. It is not controversial, and it should not be controversial. I will say, in that same conversation with Nick, I had many other moments where I was like, what do you mean that... What do you mean that you don't get this information? I've had the same conversation with Liz several times since she became the monitor. And so I guess my question for you is, does this go far enough? Does this get us? I am grateful we're here, and I am 100% on board. I just want to ask the question, because I know that there are still going to be gaps.
Yeah.
And so did you take a look at that and see if there was like synergy to add some of those things mm-hmm. to this conversation and this ordinance as well? And if so, yeah. and they're not in there, what was the thought process on that?
I remember among Nick's list were access to portals, access to software, things like that, that I think, I don't know actually if they're, if they remain an issue or if they just need to be requested. We did discuss the potential of just suits in general, and both Ashley and Liz can speak to some of these things. Not every suit is a complaint that IAB investigates or that is made to the monitor's office, so that presents a complicated situation. One of the things that I've asked is for the city attorney's office and the monitor's office to establish a memorandum of understanding as opposed to an ordinance, okay. because those things have a much more complicated path of communication rather than a strict white line of here's what we do under all circumstances. I think it is much more about what's the conversation and how do you arrive at the sharing of information that you need.
Okay.
Particularly because we've been in those meetings where they say, here is the settlement, and we ask, you know, did the case get investigated? And they say, no, nobody filed the investigation, or nobody filed the complaint.
Okay.
And so we know that there are things that go a lawsuit route and not an IAB investigation route every time. And so we know those things happen. They are probably rare, just like the non-monetary is rare, but we also have to cover all of those gaps for those rare circumstances. So that's where we left that conversation, that a memorandum be established between the city attorney's office and the monitor's office for that particular case.
Okay, really appreciate that. So mm-hmm. then I guess follow-up question is for Liz, is that a conversation, and maybe, or maybe Ashley, is that a conversation that's happening with the city attorney's office? So I will acknowledge that based on legal, ethical rules, the city attorney's office is somewhat hamstrung mm-hmm. In that as well. So I'm just curious what those conversations have looked like.
We haven't had the opportunity to have that conversation yet. Initially, when this issue came up, I did speak with someone from the city attorney's office, and I apologize that her name escapes me. And we had discussed the procedures and why notification was potentially a conflict issue for the city. So this amendment really moves forward that conversation and really gives us a greater kind of framework to work with. So I look forward to working with the city attorney's office, but I haven't had the opportunity to do so yet.
Okay, I really appreciate that, and I'm very relieved to hear that. This is one of those things that when I leave here in 2027, I hope will not continue to be an issue for future council members. So really appreciate that, and I guess then I will shift to Ashley also. I'm going to make you stand up in front of the microphone so that the public can hear.
Hi, Ashley Kelleher, Director of Civil Litigation for the Denver City Attorney's Office. I have really nothing else to add to what Liz said. We will be working with the OAM to establish a process.
Fantastic.
That we can both agree on.
Yeah, really appreciate that. Thank you. And I will just say for the public watching at home who maybe doesn't have the background here, the way our current OIM ordinance, Office of Independent Monitor ordinance, is written, it has to be a complaint made to the Office of the Independent Monitor. So there is no automatic, and there are some very tricky legal reasons for why, but there's no automatic reporting between the Office of the Independent Monitor and the City Attorney's Office. And as a result, there are times when the Office of the Independent Monitor and the Oversight Board are not notified and do not have an opportunity to investigate some of the things that we see come before us as settlements. And this is a gap, but it is also, there are legal reasons why it exists. So I think an MOU is a great option here. And I also just want to just remind the public watching at home, if you have a concern, you have to actively report it to the Office of Independent Monitor in order for them to be aware of it right now. So thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Councilmember Sawyer. Council President Sandoval.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks, ladies, for doing this. I remember getting the second letter as council president and sending it on, I think, to you, Councilman Torres, and saying, hey, how do we, how can I help? And then you both pinged me and said, hey, we've been working on this for a while. Just want to say thank you to the attorneys to also working on that, because at the time I pinged Anshul. I pinged Anshul and I asked Anshul what could be done. And he said that you two were working on that and that he was actively looking into the best tool to bring forward. I too also remember talking to the independent monitor during the George Floyd protests here, knowing that we were gonna probably get a lot, just from what I experienced going down there and seeing and watching on TV, what was to come in our future and how could we support, and did he have at the time the resources, meaning people, to be able to investigate the amount of complaints that we got. And I think if I remember correctly, the independent monitor still doesn't have the investigation, the people to be able to do all of the investigation. So I know that that's something that we put in our priority letter as a body to the mayor, and that I've continued when I'm talking to the mayor about budget, that those are still our priorities, even in a time where we have to be fiscally lean, that we're not budging on those priorities. I know I met with the independent monitor and said that I fully support that, because we have to have, it's the same as the mayor's office, where the checks and balances, there has to be some type of checks and balances when it comes to how are we providing safety. One thing I will also say is I don't, we all speak bureaucratic language. When I've talked to people in community about the Office of Independent Monitor, they don't even know what that means. It's like my zoning code language when you talk about bulk plane, yeah, and like a side interior setback and a dormer, everyone's like, wait, what are you saying? And you know, you're like, oh, you have to build the in within the envelope of your permitted area. I think that it would help, I don't know how to go about sharing that information in a less bureaucratic way of what is an independent monitor, but just I think highlighting this piece of legislation maybe can do that. But I'm always thinking about how to take internal jargon that we use at the city and be able to easily convey that to the public, because I've heard a lot of what we do here, as transparent as we attempt to be, it still doesn't compute with somebody on the outside unless you're in it to win it internally. So just some food for thought as we move forward with that list from Nick. I'm glad somebody had it, because I remember he said he was going to share it with us before he left. And then I thought he had more time, and then he was gone. Yeah, and it was like, oh dear. Okay, so I'm glad you all have that. So I was like, oh, that's a missed opportunity. So thank you, and I also am fully supportive of this.
I still can't hear.
And just want to help as much as possible. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Council President, and I absolutely heard you. So Councilmember Flynn, and then Councilmember Parody.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could I get some more data before this comes to the floor? And thank you for the briefing that we had. The Oversight Board reviewed 150 settlement agreements between 2017 and 2024. Only four included non-monetary terms. There are three examples in the presentation. Two of them predate 2017. So only one of them would have been in your review. So what can you tell us, either Julia or Monitor Castle, can you tell us what were the other three non-monetary settlements? Do we know that? And if you don't have them right now, send them to us, send them to all council by email. Because I'd like to understand what the terms were. The Emily Rice and the Jamal Hunter cases preceded 2017. So they're not even included in the four.
Julia Richmond, Chair of the Citizen Oversight Board. Our administrator, Daniel, will look that up in our data. It's been a while since he pulled it up. But what I'll say is the majority of the cases are, you know, officers bumping into someone's car and getting sued, or, you know, sort of just basic mistakes. And so they are, yes, you see those too.
Right. Are there examples, and Monitor Castle, maybe you might be the best person to address this. And during our briefing, Councilman Torres, I brought up the case of a civil litigation involving a higher education institution here in the state, and the settlement was confidential by both parties. In other words, the plaintiff or the defendant could speak about it. And this was a community college case. Are there cases like that? How would this ordinance handle something like that? Or is that something we wouldn't?
Yeah, I might actually ask Ashley. We had discussed this example as well, or question.
Again, Ashley Kelleher.
I was able to find out what the terms were.
We don't put confidentiality, non-disclosure, non-disparagement in our settlement agreements. There's First Amendment concerns because we're a government entity that arise related to that. Also, our settlement agreements are open record, so that doesn't happen.
Okay. The review of the cases since 2017, you had all of the actual settlement documents, and that's where the non-monetary terms were listed in within those.
The discovery process was quite complicated, actually. We bumped into the fact that the city attorney's office in some cases didn't have records anymore, and so we had to go back to the attorneys for the cases, you know, the plaintiff's attorneys. Good question. So there were some complexities that we bumped into with just record keeping there, which again kind of points to the fact that like this needs to have some accountability and rigor. There was, Daniel did a great job of pulling information out of those records and creating a database for us to look at, but there was a big uplift in terms of sort of research. I've got the information on your first question if you
Sure.
So Jessica Hernandez, which was a fatal police shooting settlement in 2017. Michael Marshall, we talked about 2017. Susan Green, which was a wrongful arrest for First Amendment recording in 2019. And then there was a class action selective enforcement of curfew against George Floyd protesters in 2023.
Okay. Thank you. Appreciate it. Would it be possible for, in those four cases, to send us a memo? Here's what those terms were. Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Councilmember Flynn. Councilmember Parity, and then Councilmember Parity.
Thank you. There's a lot of sort of interlinked topics and policies here, and this is a really good move on this piece that sort of picks up the work that COB did to understand what was happening here. It leads to all these tendrils in other directions, right? Some of which have already come up. I think one of the things that I've been curious about around this settlement piece, maybe from the city attorney's office, is if there are, and I think this is probably an Ashley question too, is if you all have like internal policies about when you enter into non-monetary terms and how common that is. And whether that's changed over the years. And I guess specifically in these types of cases, right? In like police brutality types cases against the sheriffs or the police.
We don't have internal policies about when we, when non-monetary terms are included in settlements. Those are often driven by what the plaintiffs are looking for in a settlement, what a city agency is willing and able to do. In settlement negotiations.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's a negotiated thing, so that does make sense to me. And part of where I'm going with that is just that if you think about like the Lyle settlement, for example, which is around how we handle people who are unsheltered and their belongings, that's a settlement that is permanently binding on the city. It doesn't have a time horizon, as I understand it. I think that's right. And it impacts like our policy in those areas sort of in perpetuity. But the original plaintiffs in that case, I don't know that they're sort of around anymore, and typically the attorney-client relationship pretty much ends when the case ends, and so you end up in sort of a strange position where the city is bound to do something, and we need to be very respectful of that. Like I'm not implying otherwise, but a lot of these settlements, these policies that are derived from certain settlements, are really addressing things that like perhaps should be legislated, and it's been interesting to see that like. And that's the way they are designed. Like they're meant to provide information sometimes in a way that like policymakers would hopefully pick up, right? Like a lot of times it's around like more transparency. Sometimes it's around training and things like that. And so I think like I'm wondering if there's maybe a need to like we hear about settlements when they happen, but I just where I'm going with this very long-winded train of thought is should we be saying in the ordinance that when the COB gets this information that we also get it? And I think I didn't say it on the slide about that. You guys can tell why I'm being long-winded.
When COB gets information, we've already approved it.
So right. We will have already compliance. Heard it. Right? Like, I'm more interested in what's happening over time with settlement compliance. Like we know about terms, okay. But then we don't know what happens with it. And I think it's important because really like in some instances we would be the most appropriate people to learn from that, like from whatever the plaintiffs and their attorneys had in mind when they said this agreement. Or even the agencies that agreed to it, honestly. So that's a thought that I've had is like, there's a lot of different roles here in oversight, but one piece of it often could be legislative and involve us.
Let us kind of talk with some of the partners that would be involved in that entire cycle to figure out who might be the right person to come back to us because
COB presumably report back to us, but.
Jessica Hernandez's case was the one that I was referencing when I referenced a community meeting that needed to take place. And so they are, in my observation, the very deliberate requests from the family or the side of the resident that is asking for these things. They had also asked for somebody, a family member, to be appointed to the then new use of force task force. So it would be great to be able to hear back that happened. It's come, you know, whatever the update might be. So we can certainly work with the monitor's office to be the bearer of that news.
To your point, we could have a role in compliance that's actually not just legislative, it turns to, which is a really good point. And you all know this about me, but before I was here, I was in the world of the attorneys who do these kinds of cases, and it was like usually maybe 20% of my caseload because I mostly did employment cases, but I handled a lot of these cases, only a few against Denver, more against other jurisdictions. And the plaintiffs that we're talking about, while their cases were working their way through the legal system, were just really well known among like again, attorneys who handle this kind of work and these kinds of settlement terms, like when you had a family that was really willing to stand up for that kind of structural change and fight for that in a settlement in addition to money, those things are like incredibly hard fought, incredibly thoughtfully negotiated and incredibly important. So I'm just really, really glad that we're taking this step to not lose track of them, because I was pretty shocked when I got the COB letter. It would never have occurred to me that there wasn't a process for tracking these settlement agreements as someone who would have been entering into them on the other side. And again, the attorney-client relationship pretty much ends when the settlement ends. And so the only people that can make sure that compliance happens are basically us in this room. So I'm just really, really grateful for COB for picking up on this, and then to my colleagues for getting this piece of it into our code, assuming it makes sense.
I don't know if you can see her, but Emily just walked, because she's behind you. She just walked up to you.
Even though my mom eyes usually look behind my head, they're looking in front of me right now.
Good morning, Council Members. Emily Locke, Legislation and Policy Director from the Department of Public Safety. And thank you, Council Member, that gave a great opportunity as well for us to help make sure that the public understands process-wise. The City Attorney's Office will take the lead in negotiating those settlement terms and the non-monetary terms. And then ultimately, the actual, I'll say, compliance with those is going to be the responsibility operationally of our agencies here in the Department of Safety. And so we're definitely looking forward to how we can kind of fit into that process and make sure that the lines of communication are clear. We absolutely agree that this is a needed change to make sure that there is increased transparency around this piece. And I believe the council members referenced, and Julia did as well, that our now, unfortunately, former executive director, Saldate, upon learning of this issue from the COB, put a new process in place operationally that when we are notified that there is a, I'll say a finalized council-approved settlement agreement that includes those non-monetary terms, that when our office receives that information, we will ensure that that's posted on the transparency section of our website to also help make sure that there's that public ability to go take a look at those terms and see those. So that's just another piece of this as well to kind of fit into the puzzle of where that information will be available moving forward.
Thank you for adding that, Emily. Thank you. And I don't have any more questions. Thank you so much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Councilmember Parity. And just want to look around the room, see if there's any other council members with questions. And Councilmember Gilmore, sorry.
If anybody else has any other questions, definitely. I wanted to reference back to what Emily was sharing around the role of the city attorney's office and the responsibility of the Department of Safety tracking these policy, implementations and knowing that, like, the reporting back. And I think it's very timely. We did it for rental licensing, et cetera. Many of our ordinances, we asked the agency or the agencies involved to come back and report to the council on an annual basis. So that is definitely a way that could perhaps be handled. And before it gets filed, we can add that clause in there unless there's any legal issue with it. But I think for transparency, it's very helpful for us to have that information. And then I think also, with that responsibility of the Department of Safety tracking this, I think that there's also a broader policy conversation about how do we, as council, since we have to approve the settlements, and by the time they get to us, if we vote against it, that means that removes that settlement for the victim. And I think a lot of times the public thinks that we have some choice at that point, but essentially what is happening, if we vote it down, we are going against the agreed upon terms that the victim's lawyer has negotiated for them, and they have accepted those terms. And so we have to honor what the victim wants to have happen. And so that's why when they come forward, I vote on them and we as a body vote on them, because that is our value. And I think that's important, but wouldn't it be great if we could do something policy-wise or a series of things policy-wise that there is more conversation and more eyes on what is happening? Because at the end of the day, these are individuals who are being harmed and killed by City and County of Denver employees. And that's the fact. And so being able to do that and, you know, giving council an idea of what the training protocols are. How has it changed? How many hours of training does an officer get on a quarterly basis? Because like we talked about before, paramedics do ongoing training, doctors do ongoing training, ER physicians do ongoing training, but I could not tell a family who is grieving a loved one, I could not tell them definitively, oh, well, our officers undergo this sort of de-escalation training. And we just recently saw a video that we see officers continuing to advance on someone who is clearly in a mental state that yelling commands at them is not going to register. Or they could have a disability. They could have a hearing impairment. And they are on autopilot. And so I would like to see where we can get to a point in training that maybe we're just backing off for a second, trying to de-escalate and proceeding forward. And we know that there are safety concerns, but there are also safety concerns when a civilian is harmed by somebody who is an employee of the City and County of Denver. And so I would love to, because I'm looking forward, I just sent it out to you, and I actually have an email from February 10th, 2021, that's from my OIM Nick Mitchell meeting, and it's a spreadsheet. So I sent you all the matrix for what we looked at when we hired Liz. And I think that's important because that is what her job is. And I want to be transparent with that to show you all that, because Liz is doing her job, which we hired her to do. And so I really want to publicly thank you, Liz, and appreciate you and Nicole for everything you both are doing, because you're keeping our community safe all over the city. And you're making sure that family members, when they engage with the city, are coming home. And so I wanted to give Julia and Liz, and maybe Julia, we'll start with you, because you worked with Nick and, you know, you were instrumental on this policy. I think it was probably yours. I know you and Nick worked on it. So I wanted to give you an opportunity to talk a little bit about some of the additional steps that we could maybe just to put it out there on the record in our committee, because I think it's important.
So the question you're asking is, what other policy ideas do we want to begin to implement?
Yes.
So I think there are a couple of things that we have on our mind. And thank you for the opportunity to sort of open the aperture on this. You know, top of mind for us is education-based development, which used to be called discipline, but I think we all agreed it wasn't actually disciplinary, which would basically undermine the entire oversight system. We have been one of the nation's leaders in terms of our oversight structure and accountability structure for more than 20 years, education-based discipline risks unwinding all of that without community input and without a clear rationale. The chief has said two things. He wants to speed up the disciplinary processes, and he wants to reduce recidivism. We have done similar research into recidivism, and for the levels of conduct that would be covered under EBD, there have been less than 5 cases of recidivism in the past 10 years. So to reduce, you know, there are thousands of officers across that time. And so it is not a pervasive problem that we need to solve. Now, the disciplinary process is long, and accountability does add steps to it. But there are also internal steps from the departments that could reduce time as well. And had the chief come to us and said, hey, let's work on some innovations to the discipline process, I think we would be more than welcoming to that idea. And certainly, we want a process that feels fair, transparent, understandable to those who are going through it, and then to those who may have been harmed, outcomes that are rational to the behavior. That's not the process that's happened here, and you know, we raised the alarm bells to council. I am not at all a dramatic woman, and I think the email that we sent to council was like, this will break oversight, and we don't say that lightly. 85% of the cases that currently go through the disciplinary process will go through this education-based discipline and or development, and mostly that will result in 1 of 5 trainings that include emotional intelligence, leadership, you know, pretty basic kind of workforce skills that you would think you would want all of your officers trained in emotional intelligence and leadership. That training can also substitute for the annual required training. So not only is it not disciplinary, it actually just helps them achieve a thing that they have to do anyway. So it's a little bit absurd in terms of its implications. So I would say that's the first thing. The second thing is, like, certainly there are ways for us to improve processes and accountability in the city, and that's why we exist. And there are, you know, many things that we're happy to work with council on in terms of improving. We have long fought for the monitor's office to have unfettered access to information. That access is not unfettered today, so we are still pushing for that to occur. I would say that there are a couple of other areas for us to look at in terms of processes and procedures. I think overdoses in the jail are top of mind for us right now. I'm sure they are top of mind for you, certainly chronic issues. And then, you know, sort of like the civil rights implications of some of the behaviors of the police department currently would be another topic. Did I miss anything that's in our annual report? I think those are top of mind. But, you know, the thing that sort of strikes me, and I'll say we had a board member resign in the face of education-based discipline, and having served on the board for about 5 years now, it often feels like David versus Goliath, right? We're a 9-member volunteer board. The mayor's office has delayed an appointment to our board for 18 months, so we're actually an 8-member board and are currently, you know, trying to raise the alarm bells of that. With Karen's resignation, we're a 7-member board. We do this in our free time, and we're coming up against, you know, sort of systems of oppression and habits of police that have been built over the course of American history, right? And so it feels like we often do these loops where, you know, the leaders come out and say, we want trust, we want partnership, we want accountability, and then sort of 2 years later, it's like, kind of, and then what we really want is for this to be easy and, you know, sort of give ourselves a high five at the end of the year for, you know, just getting the work done. And that is not at all to diminish, you know, the role of an officer. It's incredibly hard. They're dealing with really complex situations. And also, in America today, every single person has a gun. And so when police are coming, you know, to interact with somebody and that person has a gun and then they feel afraid and then they shoot that person, you know, we're sort of in this bizarre cycle of just murdering our citizens all the time. There's work to be done, I think, on that front as well. So recognizing this is a hard job, it also requires a great deal of public accountability, and we are very concerned that that accountability is being wound down. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Liz, is there something else? Thank you.
Thank you, Julianne. I would just pick up on the sentiments that were expressed by the chairwoman. The But we can't do anything without staffing, and we can't do anything without resources. And one of the things that I've looked at since I came into the position, so my position as director was empty for 2 years. Deputy Director Crittenden now served as interim director, but he wasn't in a position to be able to move forward on projects and policies because really that was not his role. So as I've come in addition to learning the system and what has been done and what we hope to do, it has become very apparent to me that we are severely understaffed. And that in order to do the things that we need to do to keep the community safe and to continue to make sure that violations, there's accountability for violations, and that we can provide a service also to the departments in engaging in what is the best practice for a policy. What are those best practices? What is good training? What does good training look like? Two heads are better than one. If we can provide assistance for and information about how to make the department better, that is an area. We're not adversarial. We're all working towards the same thing. But as you know, our budget is this big, and the departments have a significant budget. What that looks like, whether it's the OIM's budget should be tied to Department of Safety's budget, I don't know. There's a conversation to be had there because there are different types of oversight throughout the nation, and that model is been used, for example, I believe in Chicago, but they also do their own internal investigations. Currently, the departments in Denver do the investigation and the OIM reviews them and makes recommendations. So that there's a conversation to be had there, but clearly we have been lagging in terms of the things that we need to do to address our concerns, those policy issues that that Monitor Mitchell raised, and we're at the end of the line. Thank you.
Liz, I appreciate the leadership of both of you, and this has been a continued slow process. And, you know, thinking about back in 2020 and the protests and everything that happened, the Office of the Independent Monitor and the Citizen Oversight Board were so important to make sure that we were changing practices in how Denver police officers engaged with crowds for the first time in Denver's history beyond, you know, the 60s and 70s. We actually drew a line and said, we as a city will no longer do this. And especially with like chokeholds and with practices that happen within our jails and out on our streets. And for a citizen to have to lodge a complaint when something went down, when there's other city and county of Denver employees that are standing around with them. We see it on the video. We see it in the reports. Where is their duty to report? Because if any of us saw me doing something that was so egregious that the city was going to get sued over it, I would expect all of you ethically to say something, to do something in that moment, and if not in that moment, afterwards, because that's our city's reputation. That's how we treat our citizens. And this is hard work for the people that are doing it, because I have to say, the pushback that when you're doing this work is intense sometimes, and it gets scary. And especially for a lot of us, like the police, they scare me. And I am not afraid to say that publicly. I do not necessarily, I love the people and the people who are doing the job, but because of history and because of past experiences and sitting with families who are asking why, there's much more that we as a city need to do. And I'm glad that we've reopened this conversation in such a way that everybody needs to be asking the questions, because if this council is silent on it, we are saying that's okay. And it would be so horrible if in 5 years we are at a place where we are getting sued so often because of lack of accountability in training. That is not good fiscal responsibility. And when police officers are telling me, oh, I'm watching my training video while I'm riding around in the car, I appreciate the honesty, but I really don't think any of us would expect our council aides to be taking a workday training while they're driving around the district looking for things that we need to work on in the district. We would say, no, you take a Friday afternoon and you do this training. And so that's the real truth about it. And when Liz says what she says, I know she does not say that lightly. And the vacancy on the COB, on the Citizen Oversight Board, that there hasn't been somebody on there for 18 months? Why? Why? And so I just appreciate you so much, and appreciate the work and the pushback that you will receive from certain folks. And if you're going to push back on this, I really sort of question what you're trying to achieve. Because I'll tell you, I would more than take a Friday afternoon off if the city said, you must take this training and you must shut your computer and we're going to talk about how you don't harm citizens and you don't stand around and watch other people who are city employees harm other people. And so thank you, Councilwoman Torres, and thank you, Council President Sandoval, because this is really hard work to make sure that we're protecting people and then the city as well. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Councilmember Gilmore. Councilmember Gonzalez Gutierrez.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do want to thank you both for bringing this up, and appreciate all the information that you've provided. And also equally want to thank the COB and the Office of Independent Monitor and all the work that you've been doing. I know it's tricky to step into that space and to find your footing and figure out, you know, where can you push on. Just to address what you were saying, Councilwoman Gilmore, about the intervening piece, we do have in our state law failure to intervene, that it is a criminal offense, which I think helps, but I think we still are maybe missing some gaps there. But I also wanted to ask a couple of questions. One is when you said about the board members. So are we missing two board members currently? And so they are nodding their head yes. We're missing two board members. Go ahead, Julia.
Yeah. Thank you, Julia Richmond. The City Council has been very fast to fill vacancies, and we changed that process a few years ago, and it worked great. We used to be appointed like Supreme Court justices, which felt a little much compared to the role. And so thank you for that. I understand the council position for appointment is already posted. And so that's great, so thank you for that. Our general perception is that with education-based discipline, with sort of national trends, the mayor has not responded actually to our recent letters at all. It feels very much like like the city leadership is backing away from oversight. And so, you know, we're a 9-member board. It's a volunteer thing, right? And so we're, you know, 10, 15% down in terms of our ability to do stuff because we have this vacancy.
Thank you for that. And I guess just to piggyback off of that and the fact that you all are bringing, you know, this where we're talking about more transparency when it comes to non-monetary, right, and getting that information, I think it's incredibly important that I hope our administration hears that we need to fill these vacancies because they have a lot of work to do, and they need to be able to do that work efficiently and work alongside the Office of Independent Monitor and provide that oversight of our monitor. I think it's incredibly important. I can't state that anymore. The second thing I wanted to ask and I think this is also related, is around the transparency piece. And you all were talking about what were the things that, other things that would be helpful going forward as we begin to do this work. But what I didn't hear was something that I think has kind of risen up to the top. And when we're talking about transparency, and that is when it comes to deliberative process, whenever, you know, the independent monitor is working with safety on policy, right? On when there is discussion of new policies. Right now, that is considered deliberative, and you are not allowed to share what your concerns are or what your feedback has been and whether or not that feedback has been adopted. And so I'm just curious if that is something that you see as being helpful as it relates to, you know, what we're talking about today, right? Because if there are potential policy changes that are not legislative, that are administrative, is there any appetite for wanting to bolster that?
So I think this is certainly a conversation that I have been engaging with my city attorney representative, and I think it's a conversation, a greater conversation that we need to have with the city attorney's office, because it really puts us at a disadvantage where when we are following the deliberative privilege process, but it feels like others are not, and we can't respond. So we need to be clear, first of all, that we're all working under the same understanding and that the rules apply equally to all who are involved. And secondly, what exactly are the parameters of the deliberative privilege process? So as it stands, specifically recommendations about cases, that exchange going back and forth in terms of discipline cases is covered. That's an issue. No one is going to talk about individual cases or the facts of the cases. But it also covers recommendations that the OIM may make regarding policies and the back and forth. And while I understand that it's important to have that free flow of information, it really kind of, example was with EBD. I mean, the department has been promoting EBD throughout community and talking about it and talking with community members most recently about what it means, but I could not tell the community what I saw and whether what was being told to the community was consistent with what I was reading or specifically share what my recommendations are. So I really felt hamstrung and felt like we weren't both playing by the same rules. So I've addressed the council. I addressed the council a couple of weeks ago, and I think it was appropriate to bring to your attention, it's not our recommendations. These are concerns that I brought to you that I have been, and that have come to me from the community. And I think that that is an open area for discussion. But I do think that there needs to be further discussion and potentially reviews of the parameters of the deliberative privilege process.
Thank you so much.
And I do want to thank our council team that does the appointments for like making that process. It sounds like it that is like helping and working. And so I really am appreciative of how our council has done that to make sure that we are getting our appointments done in a timely manner. So thank you all for doing that.
Yeah, and I appreciate that. And we'll just say that is because we have the support of Melissa,
yeah,
who has been absolutely fantastic in ensuring that process. So it's, we can't take the credit for that.
Well, thank you either way. Thank you, everybody. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, council members. And wanted to share that what's before us is the action item on non-monetary. I did want to, as a chair, communicate because we provided publicly the date and time for the Chief Thomas's presentation on education-based development. That date and time changed because of a scheduling conflict. That rescheduled date would be August 19th, and so council will have an opportunity on August 19th at Mayor Council, correct, to ask direct questions to the chief. But back to this presentation, I have a question, council members, Torres and Gilmore, on the, I think it's, I can't see the slide page, but it's new disclosure requirements within 30 days of final settlement or council approval. There's a clear listing of that that disclosure requirement timeline. I'm curious from your research and your kind of collaborative work, were there any outliers to that timeline? Anything that would, with that clear amount of time, is there any questions that y'all may have that something may be, we may go outside of that line because of other negotiations that must occur before disclosure?
No, by the time we approve it in council, everything has been agreed to. Mm-hmm. And so once we pass it in or vote on it in council, that's when that 30-day clock begins, not before that. So it gives plenty of time for our documents to be signed and ratified and filed with the clerk and then communicated over to the COB and OIM.
Thank you so much. I just want to say thank you to both of you. When this was brought to my attention, when I received my briefing, I actually thought this was already a process, that we had transparency on non-monetary as we did for monetary. So I think this is something that's important. I appreciate the amount of work that you all put into it and the collaborative approach that you've taken on this. This is a action item.
Can I add really quickly?
Yes, please.
If we do change anything before it comes to first reading, it would likely be following up on the two things that we've heard today. One on transparency, which I think we can lean on the Department of Safety to be the responsible agent of that piece. You have the dashboard now. It could just be make it public transparent. If it's not a dashboard, it's something else. But then the reporting back to council, compliance with those non-monetary settlement agreements, if appropriate. We'll work with John and the monitor's office on just the phrasing of that so that we potentially can add those two pieces of accountability back in into this piece.
That is very helpful. And with saying that, for what's before us today, we would need a motion and a second for this.
Second.
Moved by Council Member Sawyer and Council President Sandoval. Very quickly, do we need any votes? Thumbs up. We're good. We will see you on the floor. Thank you so much. We have four items in consent. The meeting's adjourned. Thank you.